yes. In the bird, yes.
Welcome to the Lost Dot Podcast. The wheels are turning on a new adventure. The riders in the first ever Trans-Pyrenees race, designed by the team behind the Transcontinental, are rolling from the coastal city of Biarritz in southwest France, deep into the mountains. The routes they'll be riding are around 1,500 kilometres, less than half the distance of the TCR, but with the same, if not more, climbing on rugged roads and rough stuff.
Thomas Dupin, yes. Robert Goldie, yes. Mathieu, yes.
My name's Anna, I'm the race director.
My name is Rory Kemper, I'm one of the race coordinators, and I work with Anna in Lost Dot.
Lost Dot is the company that was set up to continue the transcontinental race after Mike Hall died in 2017. The Trans-Pyrenees was a race that he dreamt up and one that me and Mike recce'd for the first time in 2016. One of our missions as Lost Dot is to further Mike's legacy through continuing the transcontinental race and then working on other ideas for races that he had, and then coming up with our own designs for races based on unsupported racing, which was the kind of racing that Mike Hall championed.
Rose, yes. Neil, yep. Hiker, yes. Rachel and Jim, yes. Are you ready?
The concept of the Trans-Pyrenees race was to offer an alternative to the transcontinental. It's significantly shorter, it's only 1,600 kilometres, which is under half of what they would normally do in the TCR, but in a really beautiful part of Spain and France. The Pyrenees is pretty wild for Europe, and they're going to do a lot of climbing, and the idea of the race was to bring people here, enable them to have a different style of racing over a much shorter commitment time period. You know, the idea is that the winners will come in, they'll do it in 4 or 5 days. Most of them should hopefully be through between 7 and 8 days. So it's an entryway into this sport that we love.
So my name's Adrian Phillipson and I'm a volunteer at the Checkpoint One. So we're setting everyone off in waves of 20, I think, here, with an add-on pair as well at the back. We're in a shopping mall at the moment that is pitch black, lit by the beautiful effect of two cars at either end.
Nearly had a disaster.
Completely my fault. Let the hotel door shut when we posted the keys back through. But luckily he managed to get back through the door.
So I was standing on the side of this glass door. My bike on the other side, all my hopes, dreams and ambitions right there.
And you're like, have you got the key?
We got in.
How did you get in the door?
The brute force, which is my approach to this race.
Not even. Woken up with people.
Yeah, yeah. Rang all the numbers on the little keypad.
Yeah.
No one picked up, so there's a lot of angry people probably in that hotel, but been waiting for this for too long to let it slide.
Yeah, well, you seem like a lot more awake than most people because of that, so I think
I think it could
be a good thing.
I've had the adrenaline rush, everyone else is still dopey. Yeah.
Yeah. Who needs coffee?
I don't recommend it.
Right, have fun guys. Off you go.
We want them to have to choose to be really adventurous. part of Mike's vision and the way we've designed the race is to encourage adventurousness. One of the kind of most exciting points of the race is going to be where riders hopefully choose to climb a very steep, wild and high pass from Spain into Andorra. It's called the Port de Cabu, and they will ride really lovely Spanish tarmac up through this valley, which then turns into stone and gravel, which then becomes worse and worse quality stone and gravel as you climb the pass into Andorra. Once they're through the pass, then they have a really beautiful tarmac descent down into Andorra, where the active control point will be. The choice is that they could be doing the gravel, and but they could choose not to, and then they have a really long tarmac detour around the mountain that they could choose to avoid, and they have to climb back up the tarmac pass in Andorra before descending it again. The interesting thing for us is to see who does what and to see how it affects the race.
What I think is going to be kind of the challenging point for a lot of the riders, I think it's going to be the last bit, the Raid de Pyrénées, a classic randonneur ride through the Pyrenees. It's a homage to that. I wouldn't say it's the full Raid de Pyrénées, but it's the last bit, and it's col after col and climb after climb. And I think a lot of people are going to be like, I'm nearly done, and they've got to do like the Tourmalet. They've got big passes, and I think mentally that's going to be quite difficult for a lot of people because they're almost finished, but they've got, I don't know, the hardest climbs in the Pyrenees, and they've got like 10,000 meters of climbing, and it's like 300 kilometers or something like that. So I think for a lot of people, they're going to find that last bit quite difficult.
I like to climb, but I don't know whether I like to climb this much.
I've kind of got a plan of where I want to get to every night, but I have absolutely no concept of whether that's possible. I've never done this amount of climbing. I know I can do the distance. I have never done anything like this amount of climbing in even one day, let alone day after day after day.
Going into it, not really knowing what to expect, which is half the reason I did it, because it's the first edition. I thought that was quite exciting to not be able to look at previous editions as a sort of guide of how to approach it. But I mean, my main intention is just to enjoy it, just to get to the finish, and I honestly have no idea how long it's going to take. So just take care of myself on the road and try and have some fun.
Edie Harrison was the fastest woman in the Transcontinental Race in 2018. She recently rode the Pure Peak Grit, a 48-hour ride that linked together every known categorised climb in the Peak District. The route was over 600 kilometres long, with 13,000 metres of ascent, some 42 hills, with gradients between 10 and 25%. I asked her how the Trans-Pyrenees compared.
I think the rate of elevation is higher for this. Yeah, I did my route for this, and I was quite shocked by how much elevation there was. So I was like, I'll look back at previous rides and see if I can find one which kind of is on par with the same sort of rate of elevation. So I could go, oh, okay, I've done that, and it's just going to feel like that, you know, five times over or whatever. But even the Pure Peak Grit ride was really, you know, it was just climbing all day, every day. But even that had like less elevation than this did per mile.
The same year Edie won, Chaz Christensen rode as a pair alongside Nico Deportago Cabrera. He volunteered at the start and was helping get things ready for the riders when they arrived.
Well, we're setting up all the caps. This is how we designate all the riders, and each of the riders' trackers are associated with a cap number. And it kind of becomes the rider's identity. Like, you're no longer a name, you're just a number. So we line them all up, and this is kind of one of the big things when you check in and you get all your paperwork and your doctor's notes and your insurance, and then finally at the very end of the process when you're like registered, they give you your cap. And that's when you know, like, okay, I'm registered, the race is on. It's interesting to see a colored cap. Most of the time they're either black or white, usually white, so they show the grime. This is a nice mix of like a light chartreuse and a burnt umber. No cap number one, because there's no number one yet. No cap number 13, Be More Mike. And then there's seven pairs. So, yeah, when everyone comes, there won't be any more caps left, hopefully. And then everyone will, you know, we'll get them back 4 or 5 days later, covered in sweat and grime and just relatively disgusting.
Jazz was going to be on the start line, but tough riding earlier in the year left him low on juice to ride the brutal gradients of the Trans-Pyrenees at the pace that he was hoping. So he's stepped down, and Nico will be riding it alone.
Oh man, there's so much climbing. Like, you look at the numbers in your head, you do the math, and you're like, oh, this is, I'll be good. I'll hold like a 10 or 11 mile average. And then you get out there and it's like that, like an 11 mile an hour average with this climbs over the course of a day is a lot harder than it sounds. And I think that's about what you need to be at to finish on Monday evening. I think 11 mile an hour average would get you in like roughly within 72 hours of riding. So we'll see. We'll see how they do. I think the hardest part is going to be a lot of resupply in the French Pyrenees. There's not a lot up there, and the hours are super weird for all the shops. It's, I mean, they're not weird. They're very French. For an American, they're very strange to have, like, only the bakeries only open for 3 hours, and then the bakeries close, and nothing's open for, like, a couple hours, and then the bar's open, and then, you know, then the restaurant's open. So it's going to be hard to... I told Nico, I was like, when you see some spot to get food, like, buy, like, 6 sandwiches. Buy, like, all the food and just carry it so you don't have to worry.
We've ridden so many miles together, I've just gotten used to tuning out the mindless blabberings of our friendship, so now I'm actually taking in his advice. My name's Nico Deportago Cabrera, I'm from Chicago, and I am here to race the Trans Pyrenees solo, which is funny because this is the first year I've done anything like this by myself. I'm usually doing it with my partner in crime, Mr. Chaz Christensen. Yeah, totally on my own this time.
Is it kind of exciting that you can just push it in your own way?
It is. I attempted the Tour Divide this year, and although I wound up having a scratch, it's because I ran out of time and money, basically. I feel like I learned a lot about, you know, the difference between riding with somebody else and riding by yourself. While it was definitely lonelier, I felt like I could do longer days because, I mean, obviously you're always wanting to stop and rest. But when there's someone else with you who also wants to stop and rest, you're much more likely to stop and rest. Whereas if you're by yourself, I think it's a little easier to convince yourself to keep moving, even if you're not feeling it. So I feel like I definitely gained some experience points at the Tour Divide, maybe leveled up a bit. So it's cool I'm excited to take like what I've learned doing these solo and as a pair and put it into this race. I still feel like I had a good ride on the Divide up until I, you know, had to bail, but I definitely feel like I'm more suited to the road and gravel. You know, I feel like, you know, TCR is, or at least the ones that we did, are definitely on the road end of the spectrum, where the Divide is definitely on the mountain bike end of the spectrum. And I feel like this, or something like this, with a mix of both paved and off-road sections, I feel that kind of like splits the difference and actually kind of plays to my strengths. I mean, I say that now. Ask me again if I'm still out there like next Wednesday or something, you know, then maybe I'll be singing a different tune.
I'm Angela Walker and I'm cap number 2. I guess we're probably squashing in as much climbing in this, you know, 1,600 kilometres as I did in the whole of my TCR. So, yeah, a lot more up and down, which is why I've not bothered to fit tri-bars, because I just don't think I'll be doing that much flat, really. I don't want to go out too hard, because I'm a little bit worried that, you know, if I do, and then there's all that climbing. So just kind of pacing myself to make sure that, yeah, I don't get completely knackered and burn out, like, 2 days in or something. So
I'm Neil Phillips, cap number 17. Come into this after road season and the start of a cross season. This is probably a bit different challenge to the Transcon that I did before. There is probably 12 hours of daylight, 12 hours of darkness, so I think that's going to make it a lot harder, because you're going to need the shorter distance, you're going to need to ride like a lot. And yeah, riding in the night time is going to take its toll. I think like even on a flat road, you go slower. It seems faster, but it's not. And then on descent, you have to be way more careful. You can't see what's coming up. So it's like the descent you have to take with a lot more caution. So yeah, a lot slower.
How are you thinking about the conditions that could be changeable weather-wise?
So yeah, because of the time of the year, packing's definitely way heavier than I kind of like would have liked to, because you just got to prepare for that weather. So yeah, waterproofs, extra down jacket, thicker gloves, thick socks, waterproof trousers, a thick base layer. Yeah, just for trying to go for all eventualities, really. Here, if you're getting wet all day and then you're having to ride into the night, like the real feel is like going to be 2 degrees. If you're then descending with more wind chill, it's going to be getting down to real feel around zero.
whether you're in the Ariège, the drier side towards the Mediterranean, or whether you're here in this magical land called the Basque Country. These are the ends of the Pyrenees that very few people see, but they should. And these are the ones that are just brutal and beautiful and savage and wild and blow your mind. I'm Nicole Davis, and I'm half of Caprivelo here in Biarritz, France.
Nicole had a queue of people outside her shop on the morning of registration, riders who'd unboxed their bikes from the journey over and found they needed last-minute repairs.
It's October in the Pyrenees, and it's a very wild time of year to be cycling. The rains have come. They will probably stay. Intermittent sunshine. More of that, we hope. But yeah, it can be incredibly beautiful here in the autumn. It can also be incredibly brutal. But that's what the Pyrenees are known for, and that's why we love riding here.
So what's the reason that it's much drier on the other side? Why is there such a difference between the French side and the Spanish side?
Yeah, so I'm no meteorologist. However, the chain of mountains, I think, is what separates this weather that's rolling in off the Atlantic, trapped between the ocean and the French side of the mountains. And so the weather just sort of sits and dumps all of its contents constantly. The Spanish side, I believe, is much more affected by the dry weather coming up from Africa and across the plains of Spain. And so all this wet just is, it can't summit, right? It can't curl up and over the summit of these mountains. And so traditionally, you'll see the other side of the Pyrenees and the Mediterranean side, the French Mediterranean side of the Pyrenees, are quite dry. So this constant switching of terrain and of weather is going to be a challenge.
There are control points in Anso in Spain, Port de Cabu on the Spain-Andorra border, and Cap de Creu in Spain, all manned by volunteers. But the mandatory sections known as parcours aren't manned. On the Trans-Pyrenees, they're passive controls.
One of the events we used to run with Mike were Valley Cats. Valley Cats are short weekend versions of the Transcontinental, but because it's shorter and supposed to be more low-key, we didn't want to have volunteers, so we wanted to have passive parcours instead of what we might call active parkours with personnel, which are the volunteers. So we started working on ways to have passive parkours on the Valley Cat. The way we did it with Mike was we made these wooden boxes and put an old-fashioned alarm clock in it and got riders to photograph these alarm clocks all over Wales. So the idea was to try and bring a kind of version of that into this race, without having to put a lot of old-fashioned alarm clocks all over the Pyrenees. So we came up with a solution which is lo-fi, cheap and easy to do. So I've spent the week in the Pyrenees planting code books, hiding them around little places in the Pyrenees. And then what we do is we provide the riders with the coordinates, and they each have a unique code, and they have to go and find the code book, find their unique code, and text that to us, so we have a time-stamped code for knowing that they were there at a particular time. So yeah, we've got 5 passive parkour and 3 active control points with their own parkour. So it's fairly complex, actually. The map looks really complicated, but I think everybody's got their head around it. It's going to be really interesting for us to see how the riders kind of cope with it all.
Along the route are classic climbs of the Tour de France, like the Col du Tourmalet, the Col de Herbis, and the Col de Saleur. But the route also leads riders to some of the lesser known roads of the region. Nicole Davison from Caprivelo again.
The first few climbs on the roster are the wild card climbs. These are the ones that we don't hear about, the ones that don't pop up on the Tour de France, the ones that people are just going to meet for the first time, probably, because these hills are extraordinary climbs that should be famous in their own right. They are steep. The terrain is so unusual. Some have said it's a combination of Scottish Highlands and moonscape, or a sea of green covered with sheep. There's no rhythm to these climbs, which is going to be difficult at the very part of the race where riders are hoping to find their rhythm. There will be none.
Just a few hours into the ride, Control Car 2 was driving up one of those first twisting climbs towards the Spanish border, and I saw Nico Deportago Cabrera sat by the roadside.
Well, I had a pretty decent start to the morning. I was feeling pretty good. Bike was riding great. I was feeling fit enough, you know. I had a good plan. And I was coming down, and it was a pretty tight, like, just farm road. Super chill, just ahead of this little town. And, yeah, man, this car just came ripping around the corner. Like, I don't think either of us could see each other just because of the way the road went. And we were both cooking pretty good. And he was real tight on the inside, and so I kind of had nowhere to go. So I kind of slipped off the road a bit, and my rear wheel kind of dipped down just below the, you know, the edge of the road and kind of into the ditch. And because we were on a descent and, like, cooking, you know, when I got back up onto the pavement, I just, like, washed out completely. And I was probably doing 25 miles an hour and, like, just went, like, straight into this fence. It was, like, there's a barbed wire fence and then a metal gate and about a foot space in between it. And so I did my best to try and aim myself in between the two. But I'm not sure how it happened, like, where exactly I hit. I had to peel my bike out from, got tangled up in the barbed wire. The guy was driving, like, a, you know, a kook, but I don't even think he could have seen that I went over, like, just where I actually crashed into the fence, so he didn't stop. So I was just kind of, like, laying there in the field for a minute, just like, please nothing be broken. You know, my handlebars were kind of dipped down a bit and had to straighten a couple things out, but other than that, the bike was fine, nothing bent, nothing broken. So, you know, I was cut up on my leg a bit, cut open my bibs, which is kind of funny because I just spent, like, an hour last night sewing up a seam that had ripped on Transcontinental. I was like, I should close that up. But yeah, I didn't, you know, I just felt a little banged up. But over the last, I don't know, 25 miles or so since, I think I was at mile 47. I think I'm at mile 75 right now. So whatever that distance is, like 30 miles. I just started, like, my knee started swelling up more. I can't tell if I, like, bruised my sternum or, like, bruised a rib or something, but it's pretty swollen, like, right here. So, yeah, just kind of coming up this last stretch. As I said, I had to start breathing deeper. Yeah, it just, the pain kind of got to be a bit much. So here I am, side of the road, all miserable looking. You know, I definitely don't want to scratch. You know, I don't think any of my injuries are, like, hospital worthy or anything like that. But you know, stuff like that kind of takes the wind. That takes the wind out of your sails a bit. Sorry. So I feel like not as competitive as I was feeling a few hours ago, but, you know.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, you know, like, been pretty stoked on this race all year. So yeah, I'm just kind of, like, in my own head right now, trying to rally up a bit. Because, I mean, other than this, like, I feel good. Like, I feel prepared for this race. I'm, like, really eager to, you know, push it. And at this point, I'll be, like, super stoked if I don't have to scratch and if I can make the finisher's party. So, yeah, just trying to keep my spirits up, man. Keep the swelling down. Keep it moving.
We left Nico and began climbing higher into fog when we heard news that history had repeated itself in Innes Ogilvie's race. In Lissier's TCR, a cat ran out in front of him while he was descending and threw him over the bars. Innes hit his head and scraped along the ground, ripping his jersey at the shoulder blade. He rested and was eventually confident enough to carry on. His bike had come out of the crash unscathed. The cat, sadly, wasn't so lucky. As we came down from the fog, we heard news that Innes had been in another accident with another animal, this time in a collision with a cow that he hit with such force that when the front wheel hit it, the top tube and down tube of his frame had buckled under the impact, sending his forks back at an angle that left his front wheel beside the frame rather than in front of it. Innes sent a message to say he was okay and getting a taxi, so I was a bit surprised when I saw somebody walking a badly bent bike into the control. But it wasn't Innes. It was Flip, Cap 51.
What happened?
Descending?
Yeah, I was descending and I was just braking. I was a bit disappointing about the braking power, and then there was the bend and it was too late, and then I go straight.
So off the side of the road?
Yeah, it was quite fun. But then I flew over the steering wheel and then, it was over. I had a sort of crack and I thought, is my head or something, or my helmet? But then I took my bike and then now you see the result. It's quite, it's broken. The front wheel is next to the frame.
You can just see that you've hit something head on with that wheel.
Yeah.
And rather than hitting the down tube, it's gone to the left side of it. So your wheel has come right back and is almost hitting on your bottom bracket there. Yeah, certainly it's a steel frame, isn't it? And I can just see where the steel is dented, just as the down tube meets the head tube and at the bottom bracket.
Mm-hmm. But the wheels are still okay, so I have to compliment the wheel builder.
Yeah. Yeah, they look good.
They're boom-proof. He told me, but now I have proof. Yeah, but it's really disappointing that the race is over. I was just enjoying it after all the rain of this morning. So, that's the baddest thing, actually.
I guess you probably want a beer. Thanks for listening to the Lost Dot podcast. I'm Tom Bonnet, and I'll be bringing you more stories from the heart of the race, all the way through to the finisher's party. So subscribe for those, and if you want to keep on top of the action as it happens, you can follow the riders' dots on the GPS tracker at the Trans Pyrenees website and social media channels.